Well, have a seat. Every Sunday, I kind of ask the same of everybody about this time in the service, and that is, if you get your Bibles out that you brought, that'd be awesome. If you don't have one, we're handing them out. It's our gift to you. I want you to keep it. Put your name in it. Do whatever you got to do to make it your own. Also, you'll notice in your worship guide, there's a place for you to take some notes, a blank piece of paper. I hope to fill that up for you this morning. And then something to write with. And if you've got a Bible to read, something to write with, and something to write on, you're set. I thought it would be fun this morning, in light of where we are right now on the calendar, to remember back many years ago, even more than 30 years ago, back to when civility characterized the presidential election. So this might bring back some fond memories for many of you. If you'll watch the screen, please.
1984, October 1984, Ronald Reagan is running for re-election. He's the oldest candidate ever to be running for president. He's 73 years old. There are some concerns about his ability, especially mentally, to keep doing the job. Nobody knew anything about Alzheimer's at this point, but there were some concerns that were out there. In the first debate, Reagan against Mondale, there are moments when Reagan seems he's lost for words. He seems to go blank.
The system is still where it was with regard to progressivity, as I've said.
Walter Mondale says, looking back, he said that was the one moment he believed he really could win that election.
Today we have a brand new race.
They got 2 weeks to get ready for the next debate. There is one more debate, and Reagan has one challenge. He has got to reassure the country that what they saw in that first debate was an aberration, that he'll be fine getting a second term as president. And so he shows up for the second debate. He knows the question's coming. His people around him were trying to coach him. He told them before, no, I got it. They didn't know what he had in store. So the question comes up. The moderator says to him,
you already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also, I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
It's a great moment because obviously it's a great line and the crowd loves it, but you catch Mondale, Reagan's opponent, in the shot. There's this great shot. You get both of them on at the same time, and Mondale gets it right away too. He can't help but laugh, and he has said since then that moment he knew the election was over, and that was it. And a couple weeks later, Reagan won a 49-state landslide.
Is that not a great line? You know, today what we would call that is we'd call that a mic drop moment, wouldn't we? I mean, just stopped him dead in his tracks. Game on. Boom, here it is. And as he said, Mondale said, at that point, I knew I was done. And it's funny about mic drop, the expression, or maybe the gesture really more appropriately. That gesture kind of came around in the 80s with rappers and comedians. And when they were done, or when they were saying, you know, it's finished, I did the best I could, boom, they just dropped the mic and it was over. But what's been interesting is over the last few years, there's been a resurgence of that expression, that gesture, even making its way all the way, some of you may have seen, to the White House, and the president ending kind of his last final big speech, if you will, and just drop the mic and game over, it's done. Now, we could interpret that a lot of different ways, could we not? That's not the intent of my bringing that up, but I want to talk this morning about God's mic drop. And what I mean by that is God's triumphs. You see, one thing, life works best this way, and it's hard. I remember when I wasn't a follower of Jesus, and I know some of you are in here, and you're questioning that. You're checking that out, or maybe you're even doubting that. And I remember that what I thought life was about was about my triumphs, about my successes, about fulfilling my dreams, about ascending in my company, and those kinds of things. And I tried really hard, and in some ways, by the world's standards, there was some level of success. But that's not what's fulfilling. That's not what really makes life work. I'm stubborn, and it took me some time to realize that what makes life work is living for God's triumphs and not my own. And that's really hard because our culture today and the message of our culture today is anything but that. And that actually is becoming less popular. It's becoming less likely that people see life that way. And so this morning, as we continue in our study of the book of Daniel, I want us to look at the significance of God's mic drop, and in particular in the life of Daniel. So if you would, let's all get our Bibles open to the table of contents. You'll see you have an Old Testament, a New Testament, and Daniel's in the Old Testament. It's about a little bit more than halfway down in your Bible. So I'm going to ask you, once you find that page, turn to Daniel, and you'll be at chapter 1. I want you to get to Daniel chapter 6. We have continued to study the book of Daniel, and what's really interesting is, if you recall, Daniel was exiled as a part of King Nebuchadnezzar, who was king of Babylon, which is present-day Iraq. The Babylonian Empire was the empire of the day. And they took the best and brightest from Israel, which included Daniel. He was about 18 years old, and they exiled them. They took them over and brought them to Babylon to serve the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, there. And Daniel has stayed throughout. At this point in the narrative, he is about 90 years old. And what's interesting is that Daniel has stood the test of time. He has been faithful, he has been wise, he's been discerning, he's been respected. And as kings have come and gone, Daniel has stayed right there, surprisingly, as an exile in the thick of the Babylonian culture. Not being changed by it, but seeking to change it as God allows through the different experiences that he has among the people. And we're going to see one today that probably is his most notable one. The one that, when you think of Daniel, what do we typically think of? Rawr, the lion's den, right? That's what we typically think of. And that's where we are in the story. So I want us to read this, and we're going to kind of, I want us to look for God's triumphs, where God's drop mic moments are there. Because he wants them in our lives as well, too. And he invites us to participate because life just works better that way. My hope and prayer is that after today that you will give that more credibility than maybe you are at the moment. So let's pick it up with Daniel chapter 6. And we have a new king, King Darius. And he is part of the Medo-Persian Empire, which is present-day Iran. Iran has defeated Iraq, and now they are the empire of the day. Is it any wonder why they continue to kind of wrestle and fight today? It's because that's the history of the Middle East. But we pick it up in Daniel chapter 6. I'm going to read verses 1 through 5, if you'll follow along with me. It says, Darius decided to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, stationed throughout the realm, and over them three administrators, including Daniel. So what King Darius is doing is he's setting up kind of a new structure. And he's got these provincial kings or leaders, 120 of them. And over them are three who kind of administrate the empire through that structure. It says these satraps would be accountable to them so that the king would not be defrauded. Daniel distinguished himself above the administrators and satraps because he had an extraordinary spirit. So the king planned to set him over the whole realm. The administrators, satraps, therefore kept trying to find a charge against Daniel regarding the kingdom, but they could find no charge or corruption, for he was trustworthy, and no negligence or corruption was found in him. Then these men said, "We will never find any charge against this Daniel unless we find something against him concerning the law of his God." And then skip down to verse 10. It says, when Daniel learned that the document had been signed, of which we'll talk about in just a moment, he went into his house. The windows in its upper room opened toward Jerusalem, and three times a day he got down on his knees, prayed, and gave thanks to God just as he had done before. Okay, so let's start with Daniel. Let's just take a look at Daniel, and I want us to look for the triumphs of God in the life of Daniel up to this point. And what we have here is a clear description of Daniel's character and his integrity. His faithfulness to God are widely recognized. That's why he's so successful. That's why he's promoted as often as he has been, as we've seen in the book of Daniel, is he stands out among everybody else. Now, keep in mind, I'm sure they tried to find secret emails that compromised national security. And I'm sure they looked for sexually inappropriate statements, but they found nothing. All they found of Daniel was that as a leader, he was trustworthy. He wasn't corrupt. He wasn't taking and filling his own pocket. He was being faithful to his responsibilities. And most of all, as we see, he was faithful to his God. He was faithful to his relationship, to never compromise that. Three times a day, it says that he prayed and spent time with God. And this is coming from a guy who's been exiled. I mean, just put yourself in his shoes for a moment. Imagine if someone just took you out of America, out of Washington, out of Pierce County, out of Puyallup, and took you to a culture that you did not know, and they restricted what you could do, your freedoms, particularly your, those of you who are followers of Jesus. You couldn't worship your God. How would you handle that? Would there be bitterness and anger and angst? Daniel somehow was able to realize that this was a sovereign God in control, and he needed to leverage that. And he does it very, very well. And so what's interesting is, as they looked for a way to trap him, the only place they found that they knew that they could get him would be if they did something not to call attention to the lack of commitment and passion for his God, but to challenge him to compromise his already strong commitment. And so what we have is, and we're not going to read in verses 6 through 9, what happens is Daniel's enemies, they go to King Darius, and they want King Darius to make into a law an edict that say, for the next 30 days, you are not allowed to worship any other god. You're not allowed to petition any other person other than King Darius himself. And if you do, you will be fed to the lions. And King Darius is all for that, because this is kind of a way that he can kind of rally everyone, and he can kind of prop himself up and draw attention to himself, because that would hopefully keep the kingdom at peace and at rest. And so he goes along with this. Now, they lie to him because they tell him that everyone supports this, including Daniel. Now, Daniel wasn't there to deny that. And so he was led to believe that everybody supported this, so this would be a good decision for him as a king. And so he makes and he declares that, and he signs it into law. Now, what we have to realize is that Daniel and his faithfulness, as I said before, it's widely recognized. Now, what do we take from this? I think the way we need to look at this is we need to see Daniel, and his faithfulness was not private alone. There were private moments, but it was public. And that brings a lot of glory to God. That's like a mic drop moment for God. Here's this guy, Daniel, who's been exiled, and yet he continues to be respected and promoted. Yet he remains faithful to God. He's able to kind of balance in this tension between being in the world but not of it. And that draws a lot of attention to God. That brings God a lot of glory, because Daniel is propping up God when he does that. He's giving God props when he does that. And I think for us, it is important that we understand that God's he triumphs when we show public faithfulness. Public faithfulness, not just private faithfulness. I mean, it's really important that we understand that our faith, I'm talking to followers of Jesus now, it's a public thing. It's not something to be hid. It's not something to be covered up. It's something that we are to live out, and we're to talk about the reason for why we live that way. Now, we're to do it in a respectful way, in a humble way. We're to love selflessly. We're to sacrifice for other people. We're to do the things that Jesus did because we follow him. But here's the danger. The danger is if we do not say anything about it, if we don't attach what we're doing to whom we're doing it for. Because then the attention comes to us. Then we have the mic drop moment in which people look at us and say, man, that's a cool dude. That's an awesome woman. But we want to be pointing to God about this, because that is what Daniel did. Daniel lived the faithfulness out, his faithfulness out publicly, but people saw that it was his God. That was the reason for his faithfulness. So we need to connect our faithfulness. Let me give you a couple places in the Old Testament that draw attention to the importance of this. Let me read, let me go to Matthew. Let's see what Jesus said. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 16. Dave, I don't think you have this one because I didn't send it to you. Listen to what Jesus says. He says, in the same way, let your light shine before men so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. So even Jesus is saying, live your life in such a way that you, not that you get the glory, but that God does, which means there has to be some explanation. There has to be some talking about your faith in order to make that connection. But let me give you even a more powerful, this is one of my favorite verses in all of Scripture because of what it says. In Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10, listen to the power of the statement in terms of our faithfulness and the ripple effect. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10. This is Paul. He's talking to the church, and he's talking about the church. He says, this is so God's multifaceted wisdom. He's just been talking about the importance of the church. He says, this is so God's multifaceted wisdom may now be made known through the church to the rulers and authorities in the heavens. Now, just think about that for a minute. What Paul is saying is he's saying that when we live out our lives of faith, that is shooting a shot across the bow of God's heavenly enemies. And what we're saying is that God's way is wise. It's right. And it's a challenge because my culture says otherwise. It's a challenge because my feelings and the temptation to live otherwise is so strong in me. But I want God to be glorified. And imagine, so every time you and I live out our lives by faith, when we operate based on faith, not on feeling, not on what we want, not on peer pressure, not on what the culture might say is the right way, but when we operate by faith, think of a shot has just been shot across the bow of God's heavenly enemies. And God is standing there in a mic drop moment, and he's pointing at you, and he's saying, you see that faithfulness? That is because of me. That is because of their love for me. That is because of their commitment to me. I mean, and we face that every day, every moment of every day when we have decisions, whether we choose God or not choose God. And Jesus commands that we live it out because, again, he wants us to draw attention to God. We are not self-portraits walking around saying, look at me. We're mirrors that reflect the glory of God as he works in our lives. And so we see Daniel here, and that's the life that he lives out. Now, what's interesting about this is when Daniel finds out, Daniel hears about the decree. We'll read about it in just a minute. And he goes and he prays. He doesn't picket. He doesn't get really angry and start posting all over Facebook about how wrong that is. He simply goes back to doing what he'd done before, and he's faithful. And I want to, again, in light of where we are today, I think it's important that we remember what faithfulness looks like, because some of us might be thinking that this is kind of the, maybe some of us have had some bad experiences of seeing church people that are being vocal about their faith, and I get that. I had a community leader this week ask me a question, came into my office and sat down, and he said, why is the church so quiet on what's going on in our country today? And I asked him, I said, do you mean quiet in terms of our political voice? He goes, well, yeah, I mean that for sure, but maybe even in some other things. And I explained to him that there's a time to take a stand. Don't get me wrong. There's a time that the church needs to take a stand. Now, we need to take a stand not when it's to our advantage. We need to take a stand when people's safety is in question, when decisions are made and legislation is passed that really doesn't play out well for the health of our society and our culture. And we as a church, we have done that. We've done it respectfully. We've done it humbly at times for same-sex marriage, for transgender bathrooms, because of our concern for other people. If those laws indeed are in place, and then as they're carried out. We have spoken up in that way. But what I tried to tell the guy in my office is I said, you know what? You can't legislate morality. You can't do that. Our voice needs to be loudest about Jesus and his love. And so what we try to do is we try to talk about what it means to be in relationship with Jesus Christ, what it means to surrender and yield yourself to him, and allow the Spirit of God change, making the changes through people, so that the ripple effect of that are these changes that people want. Because what happens is if we force irreligious people to be religious and we force upon them things they don't want to do, we lose our voice to them. And we have to be really careful. And I know some of you disagree with me. Some of you think maybe that you might think High Point isn't strong enough in its political stance. You might think I'm not strong enough in expressing my political stance. And I'll tell you, you're probably right. I'm very disillusioned politically. But I'll tell you what I don't have one question about. I do not have one question about Jesus Christ. I don't have one question about the fact that he was raised from the dead. I don't have one question about the fact that he's changed my life radically. When I sought my own well-being, when I sought after the things that I wanted, and when I asked him to become Captain King and CEO of my life, out of desperation, realizing my brokenness, he has worked in me ways in which no legislation, no political candidate, no program could ever do. And so I believe our role as a church, more than anything else, is our voice needs to be heard and our lives need to be seen and they need to be matching and aligning. We need to speak about Jesus in the way that Daniel, who lived out his life and was very vocal for his God, did. And we hopefully are drawing encouragement from this. Now, just two things I want to say about this from the first thing that we see here. First off, Daniel was faithful with the small things, and that prepared him for what was in front of him, which we're about to read. And that's what we need to be mindful of. Our faithfulness needs to be the everyday, ordinary decisions, and we face them every day. Do I go God's way or do I go the culture's way? Do I go God's way or do I go my way, selfishly speaking? Every day we face those decisions, and it's through the regular, daily, ordinary times in life. When we choose God, faithfulness to God, faithfulness to God's word, faithfulness to his glory, to his triumphs, that we then become ready for the more difficult things in life. And then the second thing I want to note, and this is worth writing down. Do you notice that Daniel's doing well? He's popular. He's respected. He just does things right. The problem is, even in doing right, trouble finds Daniel. And so there are no guarantees. When we do right, there are no guarantees. God might have a larger purpose, a grander purpose for our lives, even when we're doing the right things. Even when we're, as we think about our relationship with God, it's good. I'm honoring God. I'm talking to God regularly. I'm living for him. Why are these bad things happening to me? Because there is no guarantee that when we do right, we get right, because God might have a grander purpose and plan. And Daniel is going to run smack dab into that right now. Let's go back to it, verse 11. So we've seen the character and integrity, the trustworthiness of Daniel. We've seen how the only way they can get him is through his relationship with God. Can they challenge him in a way that he has to choose God's law or the king's law? And so they lie to the king to make this edict in which Daniel is going to be challenged. Verse 11. It says, if I can find it. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel petitioning and imploring his God. So they go looking for him now. The edict's been passed. They go out to him. Why? Because this is what Daniel does. This is a part of his ordinary, everyday way in which that he lives. And so they go out, and sure enough, there he is. Now skip down to verse 13, because they come back to the king and say, King, remember, you made this edict, right? And he's like, yep, check, I did it. And it's 30 days, right? And if anyone did this, you're going to be thrown in lions. Yep. So then they say to him in verse 13, then they replied to the king, Daniel, one of the Judean exiles has ignored you, the king, and the edict you signed, for he prays three times a day. As soon as the king heard this, he was very displeased. He set his mind on rescuing Daniel and made every effort until sundown to deliver him. Then these men went to the king and said to him, you as king know it is law of the Medes and the Persians that no edict or ordinance the king establishes can be changed. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, again, there it is, that faithfulness, whom you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and with signet rings of his nobles so that nothing in regard to Daniel could be changed. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and he could not sleep. So Daniel encounters something for his faith that we most likely, any of us in here, will ever face, and that is death. And so Daniel, apparently, we have nothing to believe otherwise, he did not fight it. He did not speak against it. He trusted his God, and he was thrown into the lion's den. Now, I'm asking you, do you see the mic drop moment here? Do you see the triumph of God in this narrative? I mean, here Daniel is. Imagine, and they did this for sport back in the day, right? In the Roman Colosseum, they would put Christians in the Colosseum, and they would send the lions out, and it was a sport. This was a punishment in the Near East. This is a very familiar punishment. We talked about how people were burned to death as well. We talked about that a few chapters ago. But here we have Daniel knowing he's going to be put into the lion's den, and his faithfulness stays intact. And it's like God is just like, boom, King Darius, you got nothing on me. Game over. This is my man. This is a faithful man. And he's dropped. And I mean, Darius sees that. He wants him out. He knows the reputation, the character, and the integrity of this guy. But he cannot do anything about it. And he even almost, like, there's like a little prayer there. May your God rescue you. And so we see in this moment that God's triumph is seen in our worst moments. Now think about this just for a second. Put yourself there for a minute, okay? Why didn't Daniel just pray to himself for 30 days? Why just, here's the edict. Okay, I hear that. I'm just going to kind of mutter under my breath. Why not shut the window so people couldn't hear him praying aloud? Why didn't he do that? Why not just cool your jets for 30 days and not do anything, thinking wisely that I can do more alive than I can dead? Would we not be thinking about that? Do we not kind of face that in our everyday lives when we're having to decide between God's way and our way? Do we not find it easy to rationalize because this is the easier route to go? Why didn't Daniel do that? I mean, we might all think to ourselves, well, yeah, I mean, 30 days, really? Just kind of mutter under your breath? I mean, you're still praying to God. What's wrong with that? Well, what we don't understand, but the reason chapter 6 is in here, is that Daniel feared God more than he feared death. And when I say feared God, I mean revered. He respected God more than anything else. And that's what sets him apart. Now, I just want to ask you, just think about this for a minute. Do you fear God more than anything else? Do you fear God more than anything else in your life? Because that's where God does his best work. That is where his triumph is seen, most notably in the faithfulness of people who fear God more than anything else. You see it at work. You see it at play. You see it in relationship. You see it on the battlefield. When you love God more than anything else. And that is what Daniel was reflecting. And what's fascinating about this is we have a stronger basis for our faith than Daniel did. Now, granted, Daniel had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel had God revealing to him a dream that no one else could reveal because his life was on the line. God, I mean, Daniel had that. But we have God who came down in the person of Jesus Christ, flesh and blood, walked around the earth, taught, loved, served, did miracles. Then he was crucified, then resurrected from the dead. We have accounts of that that Daniel didn't have. And we have the Spirit of God that now comes inside the life of followers of Jesus Christ to empower us. Daniel did not have that. And yet, he had faith. Where does that come from? Why not do the wise thing and shut up for 30 days? Why not do the wise thing and just be quiet and pray to your under your breath? Why not do that? Because Daniel understood something about wisdom. In Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, listen to what Solomon says. He says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and discipline. What Solomon is saying is that life makes sense And we can make sense of life when it starts with our fearing God more than anything else. When we respect Him and revere Him, when we seek to follow Him and we surrender Him and we yield to Him, when we do that in our thoughts, in our attitude, in our posture, in our actions, in our words, in every way, life will make sense. We will be wise and discerning of the times. And Daniel was. And Daniel knew that if he feared God more, that would take care of itself. And then in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus has a word to say about that as well. This should pop up on the screen, verses 32 and 33. I mean, Jesus had some hard things to say. Chapter 10, this is for free, no charge for this, all right? Read Matthew chapter, I'm talking to followers of Jesus, read Matthew chapter 10 today or tonight. I dare you. Now, I think a couple weeks ago I challenged you to read the book of Matthew. When you get to chapter 10, write down all the questions you have. Write down, whoa, but this is just a small snippet. Matthew chapter 10, verse 32. Therefore, everyone who will acknowledge me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father in heaven. Jesus is saying to his followers, if you're really a follower of mine, you will not deny me before men. If they ask you, you will give an account for your life and the person for whom you serve. If you see a situation you need to speak into, you'll speak into it. You'll pass along where salvation comes from, how forgiveness from God comes, and for whom Jesus came for that to be possible. You'll do that. You won't be afraid of it. Because when we come to follow Jesus, we are setting aside everything. We're laying everything down, and we're saying that fearing God, respecting God, revering God is more important to us than even our very own lives. And that is what Daniel has done here. And that's what he's calling us to do. That the wisest thing we can do in the moments, the most difficult moments in life, is we can respect Jesus, we can fear Jesus more than that situation, even if it's death itself. That is what Daniel tells us. That is how Daniel lived. And here's a question I think it's worth writing down. If following Jesus were illegal today, would you be arrested? Would people know? Would people say, I think that guy is following Jesus. I think that lady is following Jesus. If it were illegal today, would you be arrested? Would you be worried that you would be arrested? In other words, are you living your life in such a way that people who are not followers of Christ see you and recognize something's different about you, that they understand you're a follower? I'm not talking about, because hopefully a church person would never turn in another church person. I hope that would never happen. That'd be terrible. And when I say church, I mean a true follower of Jesus. I realize there are people in the church that are not followers. But I just ask you that question. It's a good diagnostic question. So, we see God's triumphs in the open faithfulness of his people. We see God's triumphs when he comes to us in our worst moments, whatever those may be, when we're faced with a decision between trust God or trust something else. Lastly, we see how this plays out. Verse 19 of Daniel chapter 6 says, at the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he reached the den, he cried out in anguish to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God. The king said, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Then Daniel spoke with the king. May the king live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths. They haven't hurt me, for I was found innocent before him. Also, I have not committed a crime against you, my king. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to take Daniel out of the den. So Daniel was taken out of the den uninjured, for he trusted in his God. And then in verse 24, Daniel's enemies, along with, sadly, this was the Babylonian way, or the Persian way, I should say, the ancient Near East, not only were his enemies thrown into the lions, but so were his family. And then in verse 25, we see this incredible statement from King Darius. Because what we have here is when Daniel comes out of the lion's den, and he's not even scratched, at that point, I mean, God's like, boom, game over. God's rescue of his people is his greatest moment of triumph, because God is a rescuing God. And he rescues Daniel here. And he did that to encourage the people of God. And then even Darius recognizes this. In verse 25, it says, "Then King Darius wrote to those of every people, nation, language who live in all the earth, 'May your prosperity abound. I issue a decree that in all my royal dominion, people must tremble in the fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will never be destroyed, and his dominion has no end. He rescues and delivers. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth, for he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions.'" Boom, there's a statement that acknowledges defeat. It acknowledges the triumph of God. Now, what I want to go back to just a moment is Daniel says in verse 23, it says, "For he trusted in his God." So here's my question. What about the others? What about those who have trusted in God but weren't delivered in the way that Daniel was? What does that mean? I think of in Hebrews chapter 11, there's a whole chapter devoted to very faithful men and women of God, and there's several verses that mention those who were sawed in half, those who were burnt, those who were tortured, those who were killed. What about them? Why weren't they saved in the way that Daniel was saved? I think about today. Today is the International Day of Prayer, in which we recognize the persecuted church. Followers of Jesus Christ today, right now, because of their faith, who will not renounce their faith, are killed, they're tortured, they're executed, they're shunned. Why are they not spared in the way that Daniel was? But where it really hits home are the people that I've met over the years in High Point Church, and even the ones today who sit in this congregation right now, who are in the midst of their worst times, and God has not pulled them out. I think of some wonderful men and women of God who have died, who I prayed and many people prayed that God would deliver them. Why didn't he? Did they not have enough trust in the way that Daniel did? Not at all. What we have to recognize when we yield and surrender our lives to God is that he has a plan for each one of us individually. And that plan is different for all of us. And God has different outcomes for our worst moments in life. And I want to give credit to Beth Moore for this. I appreciate it as I was studying her teaching on this chapter. And here's what she said. She says there's three outcomes to the worst matters in life. And the first is that God saves us from our worst moments to build our faith, to add to our faith. That he saves us from them. He pulls us right out. You know, you get that diagnosis, there's a lump, and you send it off to oncology, and you're just praying, "God, please, may it not be cancer, may it not be cancer," and it comes back, and it's not cancer. And you're so thankful to God for that. And it adds to your faith. It builds your faith up. But then there also are the ways in which God saves